I think one of the things that whenever we talk about sepsis that strikes me is that it's preventable, and that's what makes it so awful.
There isn't a single right antibiotic for that would work always for all the children that attend all the hospitals in the UK and perhaps the world.
Antibiotics stop sepsis. Antibiotics within 60 minutes save lives.
Perhaps we have not had this discussion about sepsis and how very different types of presentations you might see.
It's very difficult to know how to give the right doses. And it's very difficult because children metabolize differently at different ages.
It is, at the end of the day, a killer.
Pediatric sepsis is rare but serious, and it is still the most common preventable cause of death and disability in the UK. Antibiotics and supportive care is vital. Right choices matter. So today we're going to be running through drugs and bugs in pediatric sepsis. Hello and welcome to our Pediatric Sepsis podcast series, brought to you by the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health and the team from the Great North Children's Hospital, with guest speakers from all over the country. My name is Emma Lim, and I'm a general paediatric consultant. From the world of bugs emerges Luthea, my personal go-to phone-a-friend. Everyone should have a friend like you, Luthea. Luthea is a consultant microbiologist and director of infection and prevention control for Newcastle-upon-Tyne NHS Foundation Trust. And Luthea, I was much too scared to say your whole entire name, so would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Emma. My name is Luthea Pareja Cebrián, and thank you very much for having me today.
So I wanted to start with some really basic questions. What are the common bacteria that cause sepsis in children?
So we've seen a big change in this throughout the years, and a part of it has been due to vaccination. So perhaps we see less pneumococcal sepsis and Haemophilus sepsis that we used to in a few years ago. At the moment, there's also variability depending on the time of the year and the organ in question. So sometimes you might see group A strep sepsis, and we have seen that coming up over the last couple of years. There's been an emergence of those type of infections. We also see gram-negative sepsis in children that present with appendicitis or urinary tract infections. So there isn't a single source, and there isn't a single organism. I think it depends very much on organ.
I think it's a really important point that the kind of bugs that cause sepsis have changed over the years due to vaccination. They also change throughout the seasons, and we have seen a big surge in group A strep in the spring and in certain places and parts of the country. So in winter, with the flu season, we see more staphylococcal infections. And when you're thinking about children who come in through paediatric emergency department, what is your first go-to off-the-shelf antibiotic for community-acquired paediatric sepsis, and why?
That is a harder question to answer than initially may look like, because there's individual hospitals will see different organisms that display different sensitivity patterns, and that's associated with resistance, antibiotic resistance. That's something that we all hear about quite a lot. So there isn't a single right antibiotic for that would work always for all the children that attend all the hospitals in the UK and perhaps the world. And we do have specific guidelines for that in every hospital in the country. For example, in a child that comes in and is well and has no significant problems or health problems, we might perhaps say cefuroxime is a good antibiotic, or perhaps coamoxiclav is a good antibiotic.
So as usual, it's take a history, mm-hmm. Find out if there are any other serious problems, look at your local guidelines, because you will have local guidelines, and follow them. And in community-acquired sepsis, straightforward antibiotics, so cephalosporins and coamoxiclav, can be used. Now, one of my other bugbears is that I think that people don't really understand cephalosporins, and they use them really interchangeably. So people don't really think about what's the difference between, say, cefuroxime, cefotaxime, ceftriaxone, ceftazidime. So I'm hoping that you've got an easy way for us to help think about which one to choose.
So we class cephalosporins in first, second, third, fourth, fifth generation, depending on how sophisticated they are in their production. They behave very differently from in many ways. So how they are absorbed, how much they are absorbed, where do they penetrate, how are they metabolized. And so all of those facts are very important to consider, because they are not all cephalosporins are going to get everywhere, and not all cephalosporins are going to do a very good job of sepsis in every child. So those aspects of how antibiotics behave are called pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics, and they are is part of the information that is considered when you prescribe a dose in for a condition. And the most commonly used, such as cefuroxime and cefalexine, are commonly used for UTIs. Cefotaxime and ceftriaxone are used for generalized sepsis, and they are very, very good at penetrating into central nervous system and respiratory tracts. Ceftazidime is a bit more sophisticated, because it just covers some of the organisms that display many resistance, such as Pseudomonas. So we don't use an awful lot of them in generally for children. And then we have very, very, very sophisticated cephalosporins at the moment, such as ceftolozane and ceftobiprole. And they are very, very specifically targeting the emergence of resistance in certain bacteria.
And have we used any of those sixth generation cephalosporins in children, or not much?
Yes, we have. It's very complicated to decide how much we're going to use, because a lot of them are very, very new, and they haven't really been trialled in children. And children behave very differently when they metabolize antibiotics. Even when you look at, when you compare a neonate and a three-year-old, they handle their antibiotics really, really differently. So have we used them? Yes, we have. Do we use them regularly? We try and avoid using them as much as possible, but it's part of the armamentarium that we currently have available to us when the going gets tough.
So not all cephalosporins are equal. So the first generation, you need to think about using those for urinary tract infections. Cefotaxime and ceftriaxone are good for sepsis. Ceftazidime covers Pseudomonas. And there are newer antibiotics and cephalosporins that can be used in resistance, but that's quite experimental. It's very difficult to know how to give the right doses. And it's very difficult because children metabolize differently at different ages. But in general, if you've got a child with sepsis, what kind of a dose do you want to see a child on?
The maximum dose available and possible for their weight.
That says it all. I think if you are thinking about a really serious infection, you need a high dose. And one of the problems that we always run up against is giving an intravenous push when you're in the resus room versus using an infusion when you maybe only have one cannula. So how do you get around that?
Not all antibiotics are available in boluses, but most of the ones that we use for first line sepsis treatment can be given as boluses. The other important factor to take into account is that you can deliver infusions as very fast infusions. So even the antibiotics that need an infusion, they can be administered within 20 minutes, which is a very, very short time. And that can be the difference between saving a life.
I want to have a shout out to all those pediatric and emergency department trainees out there who have ever struggled to get in a cannula. This is one of the things that everybody struggles with it. So what is it that's different about neonates, and that's infants under a month old? What are the organisms that cause sepsis in neonates, Luthia?
We see gram-positives as the most common organisms causing Lyme infections. And they can be anything from coagulase negative staph, commensals, so they live harmlessly on the skin, but in neonates we see that they can cause Lyme infections, and that's to do with their immaturity and perhaps translocation from other places other than the skin. So they can, bacteria can travel from their gut into the bloodstream and then land, if you like, into their lines, and then they become a possible source of infection. So if I had to write a top 10 organisms in causing Lyme infections in neonates, I would say gram-positives, coagulase-negative staph, and staph aureus would be my top two gram-positives. And then I would go on to all the gram-negatives, so E. coli, Pseudomonas, serratias, and all, some of those organisms live in the environment, and they have been selected out because of the high usage of antibiotics in those environments, so they are around.
I love the top 10 of Lyme infections, and I think number one is always coagulase negative staph. We see that so much. So what antibiotics, if we see a child who we think is septic in hospital, who or coming into hospital with a central venous access device in place, what extra antibiotics do we need to think about adding?
If a child has a long-term IV device, then you would be thinking about adding teicoplanin or vancomycin onto whichever antibiotic cocktail you're considering.
Check out the RCPCH's face-to-face How to Manage Paediatric Sepsis course and all our other educational events at www.rcpch.ac.uk/courses.
But what about sepsis in the babies that come in through ED? So they're not necessarily premature babies, but they're babies with a fever. What sort of things do you need to think about that might not affect older children?
For smaller babies within 6 months of birth, you'd be thinking about group B streptococci, you'd be thinking about E. coli bacteria, bacteremias, and perhaps late presentation of listeria infections, which is rarer, and they usually present sooner, but you'll have to add that into the mix.
So when did you last see listeria?
When I was a last year registrar, and I saw two in a row in babies, and I was very taken by how devastating a disease it was, and it's something I would never forget, and the story behind it was quite remarkable as well. I have seen more listerias in adults than I have in children. This mum that had gone out for dinner 2 days before being induced, and she'd had some homemade ice cream in a lovely restaurant that was her favourite restaurant that she always went to. And this ice cream was presumed to have listeria, as we know is a risk. And the baby was born, and the mum was unwell. And in fact, we treated her for sepsis. And the baby was born with listeria sepsis and was described as coming out of the womb mottled and grey and terribly, terribly looking. And there was a terrible, terrible outcome of this. And we know that listeria presentation can be a bit later, so you can have a relatively healthy-looking baby that then goes home within 24 hours and then comes back really quickly. This wasn't quite like that, but you must never forget listeria in very, very small babies.
I think one of the things that whenever we talk about sepsis that strikes me is that it's preventable, and that's what makes it so awful. And your story of this listeria is so awful because you just think, if she hadn't eaten that ice cream. And you always think about the children that if they'd come in sooner or if they'd been treated. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so important to think about, because this is where we can really make differences.
I think you've struck a very important point there. We have all been very well trained in identifying rashes and doing the GLAS test and meningitis, and these are the signs and symptoms that we ought to look for. And perhaps we have not had this discussion about sepsis and how very different types of presentations you might see. So from the listless child to a fever or a rash, and how is it that we can identify and explain this to all those parents and guardians of all those children and out there, that is not just meningococcal sepsis that gives you a rash that is identifiable with doing that simple and effective GLAS test. It's all these other conditions that can lead to a severe infection. Let's not forget that what sepsis is, which is an infection, and it's a combination between an infection and a host response, and how we can all have different responses that lead to very different presentations, but it is, at the end of the day, a killer.
Absolutely. And I think one of the other things, we talked at the beginning about having hospital guidelines to help you make antibiotic choices. And I think we also have microbiologists. I described you as my go-to phone a friend. And I think that as a junior, you're always a bit nervous to pick up the phone because it's almost always at night. And then you think, I'm not quite sure what to say. So, Lucia, when you think about people ringing you at night to get advice, what do you want them to be able to tell you? What are your things that you think, what makes a good referral for you? What do you want them to tell you on the phone?
A good history. Have you seen that patient? What did you see that worried you? What are the reasons? Why are you phoning? What is different now that from what your patient looked like 4 hours ago? So what has changed? What's worrying you? The history, why were they in hospital in the first place, or what has brought them to hospital? And what are you trying to get as an answer? So are you after an antibiotic or are you after a diagnosis? We might give you a list of differential diagnoses, and we are really very good at that, but we are not there with the patients. We complement each other, the person that phones and the person that contacts us. And us, we can make a really good team in fitting the pieces of that jigsaw so they actually make sense. Allergy is one of the biggest difficulties in the middle of the night, because everybody will tell you they're allergic to penicillin, but nobody really is, or not as many people as we think are. Different reactions, such as I get a headache, I feel sick, those are not allergic reactions. We need to understand allergy a little bit better, and that history around allergy is absolutely crucial.
Thank you. I think that's really important. So I think if you're picking up the phone at night to your microbiologist, first of all, do it. It's much better to do it than not, because they're almost never cross. They're not surgeons. What do you want from that phone call?
History, results, and allergy history.
If you were thinking about sepsis, what are the top three things that you want your juniors to think about when you see a hot septic child?
Take good samples. So blood culture, CSF, urine, whatever's relevant, focus on those. Give antibiotics as soon as possible and don't panic.
And pick up the phone. They're there on the end of the phone to help you. So don't be scared to give them a ring. So in summary, A, antibiotics stop sepsis. Antibiotics within 60 minutes save lives. B, I go for big doses. 80 milligrams per kilo, use it or lose it. And C, think of cephalosporins, cefotaxime, ceftriaxone. These are perfectly good first-line choices in paediatric sepsis. Nothing is ever simple, especially not at night. So for anyone who has ever been asked to see a patient with fever at night, or really just to assess a child who's not quite as well as they have been, but nobody knows why, here are some tips on these complex cases. There are this group of children with complex health conditions, and they're often already in hospital. They may be having surgery or treatment for their underlying conditions, such as cancer, genetic conditions, neurodisability, or immunodeficiency. And these children are much more at risk of infection and therefore sepsis. And these are the scenarios where it's not straightforward and you need to think about getting advice and adding other antibiotics. So this is hospital-acquired infections, bugs and drugs. Luthea, in hospital-acquired infection, what different kind of organisms can we expect?
Regardless of age, there are certain target organisms that we always look at, and those are Staph aureus, whether it is sensitive to methicillin, so we call it MSSA, or resistant to methicillin, so we call it MRSA. We also look at C. diff, and we also look at gram-negative infections such as E. coli, Pseudomonas, and Klebsiella. Those, at the moment, are part of our mandatory reporting of healthcare-acquired infections.
In hospital at night, what three things do you want a junior doctor to think about when they go to these complex patients? Three things.
Wash your hands before you see the patient and undertaking any procedures. Look at the child and consider, what is it that they came in with and what is the current problem? And if in doubt, call a microbiologist to guide you through their therapy.
Spoken by a true microbiologist. Wash your hands. Look at the patient. What has changed? And ring for advice. That's excellent. When somebody rings you up and tells you they have a child with hospital-acquired sepsis and they've already been in, what kind of choices of antibiotics would you suggest?
We would probably suggest tazosin, so that's piperacillin and tazobactam, plus or minus the addition of either teicoplanin or vancomycin, depending on how many devices they have. But usually those would be our go-to antibiotics.
Great. So in more complex children, you'll be looking at broader spectrum antibiotics like piperacillin, tazobactam. If they've got lines in, you think about adding teicoplanin or vancomycin. So I have to ask you, because we always get our hands slapped, when can we use meropenem?
We try and use less meropenem as a first-line drug because we are concerned about the emergence of resistance to meropenem. Meropenem is really important because it's a very, very broad spectrum. It's fantastic. It's really well-tolerated. And it'd be a shame if we can't use it readily. So we would like to use meropenem when other antibiotics have failed. And certainly as a second-line antibiotic. So meropenem is a very important addition to our antibiotic armamentarium. It's very broad spectrum, so we would like to enjoy using it for many, many years. It is therefore very important that we don't abuse it. So we leave it as a second option, a second choice when there is a history of resistance or when we have used other agents and they haven't worked, when there is an allergy or when there is contraindication because the children or the patients are on other other treatments and there might be interactions.
So I'd just like to say thank you very much and goodbye from me, Emma Lim.
Goodbye from me, Lucia Pareja Cebrián.
This is the Paediatric Sepsis Podcast Series brought to you by the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health and the Great North Children's Hospital, and thank you to our guest speakers.
The Paediatric Sepsis Podcast Series was brought to you by the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health and Medisense, with support from Health Education England.